It is Saturday, November 23rd, 2013. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, hosting today, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a technology teacher, musician, web developer, gardener, etc., etc.
Hey.
How's it going, Ben?
It's going great. How are you doing?
You know, I'm doing really well. Lots to talk about today. I'd like to kick off the conversation today. We got an email from one of our listeners, Perry in Monterey, who was concerned about all the security things we were talking about last week.
Yeah.
They said, early in today's show, you discussed how hackers could set up mini stations to get into nearby cell phones and mess up their use and or listen out on their users' activities. As you say, geeks may already know this info, but you could be providing ideas to potential terrorist persons, groups, or people not familiar with this vulnerability. So what about that? Aren't we being socially irresponsible? What do you think, Ben?
I don't know. I mean, by some definitions, certainly you could spin it that way. But my thought is the news that we get for GeekSpeak, we get from websites that have a lot more readership than we have listenership, right? So if you were a potential terrorist or if you were looking to exploit some kind of a security vulnerability, you will probably already be following the security sites, right? The sites that disclose these vulnerabilities. Now, those sites don't just disclose vulnerabilities whenever they find them. They make sure that basically they make a decision, like, does it make sense for us to disclose this or for us to not, for us to keep this private? And so I think in that way, we're very much following their lead in terms of what vulnerabilities are public and what vulnerabilities are not. It definitely would be irresponsible, though, if I found a vulnerability personally. I would never disclose it on the radio. I would contact the person who makes the software or the hardware and say, hey, did you know about this? Are you fixing it? And then work with them before I disclosed it.
So basically what you're saying is that GeekSpeak joins a public conversation already in progress.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what I'm also hearing is that we are not yet a go-to place for people on the bleeding edge of technology.
Well, not for security news,
not for security news, at least.
And you know what? I'm fine with
somewhat
that.
Somewhat humbling.
I don't think it's humbling at all. I freely admit that I know hardly anything about security compared to security researchers. I mean, you know, I read about this stuff, but I'm ultimately reading a lot of the same articles that just other people who are interested are reading. You know, I don't have any special, I guess, you know, way into it or something.
Right, right. Now, it becomes a little more complicated when you talk about larger security conversation out in the public, like when Snowden releases a bunch of documents. The same argument that Perry of Monterey is making about our show and when we discuss security vulnerabilities could be made on the national scale. And there, I imagine things get a little more complicated.
Yeah, it's a complicated debate. You know, do you release documents when things are going when things are strange within an organization? Are you the whistleblower, or do you decide no, it's socially responsible to be the whistleblower because there could be unintended other consequences, and maybe, you know, you can blot out names and stuff like that to try and anonymize and minimize your damage. But it's kind of an interesting cost benefit analysis to play with.
Right.
Of course, in this place, in this case, GeekSpeak is not the one breaking the story.
We are never the one breaking the story.
Edward Snowden. Well, I guess Edward Snowden wasn't quite the one breaking the story, but
he was aggregator.
He was giving very specific evidence for the story, but we already kind of suspected a lot of the stuff.
Yeah. Tin hats are having such a good time right now. Well, we got another tip from another listener, Bill Davis, who let us know about the security audit being planned for TrueCrypt. Now, this is encryption software that has a reputation for being easier to use than other more cryptic encryption software.
Another great thing about it is that it's open source. So anyone can look at the source code. Anyone can see what it's actually doing.
Mm-hmm. So he said he pointed us to the fact that there is, and he pointed us to a Computer World article at computerworld.com saying that the NSA spying is prompting open TrueCrypt encryption software for an audit of those things.
Yeah. So basically there was a Kickstarter, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. No, it's an Indiegogo campaign. I think it's an Indiegogo campaign.
Oh, maybe it is. Anyway, there was a campaign basically saying, hey, everybody, we want to audit this open source software to make sure that it's good, basically, mm-hmm. to make sure that there aren't any weird things going on, there aren't any situations where the open source software is what everyone's seeing, but the software that you download, the package that's mm-hmm. nice and easy to mm-hmm. install, mm-hmm. maybe something different, things like that. So there were some suspicions around that. And so now there's been this campaign to raise a little bit of funding to do that, and it was successful.
Yeah, apparently in October, a cryptographer and blogger outlined his concerns in a post, saying that, for instance, the Windows version of TrueCrypt, which is the one that most people use, differs enough from the Linux version that there might be a possible backdoor or other deliberate compromise in the software. So they just want to check it out and make sure that everything's on the up and up.
Suspicions being the NSA?
The NSA right. But also pointing out that if the NSA is doing this, then we can assume that other organizations, perhaps in other countries, might be doing this also. One interesting thing about the fundraising campaign to create this audit is that over $57,000 have been raised, not just dollars, but also bitcoins. And this gets to something that I want to talk to you about, Ben, which is the rise of Bitcoin in the public consciousness.
Bitcoins, yes. They have been rising in my consciousness as well. They're very interesting. So the thing I don't want to do on this particular episode is talk about technically how it works, because it is extremely involved if you really want to understand every piece of it. Mm-hmm. But if you just kind of, fuzz over the very specific details, if you want more information about it, it's all explained on the Bitcoin website and on Wikipedia and on various other resources. Yeah. But the idea is basically that Bitcoin is a kind of money that you can give to somebody. You don't have to be physically where they are, like cash, mm-hmm. and you don't have to go through a central figure like a bank or mm-hmm. a credit card company.
Or PayPal.
Yeah. You don't have to go through anybody, because it's direct, it's peer-to-peer, and it's a network, and because of the incentives for being a participant on the network mm-hmm. and ensuring the security of the network and the validity of the network exists. And so, so if I wanted to send you, let's say, some amount of bitcoins or mm-hmm. some fraction mm-hmm. of a bitcoin, then I would send it using some software to your receiving address, and then that transaction would go up into I'm just going to say the Bitcoin cloud, right? Mm-hmm. The miners that are all validating transactions. There may be a fee associated with it if I choose to do so. Maybe
like a transaction fee?
Yeah, I want this transaction to go through faster, so I'm going to put a fee on it. Well, that fee may be 6 cents or something like that.
Okay, it's itty-bitty.
Minimal, right? It's nothing like the credit card fees or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so the miners will validate that. If I don't associate a fee, it might take an hour. And
that's a long time.
I know. It's a lot faster than most transactions nowadays with real money. But if I decide to put a 6 cent or a 10 cent or a 5 cent or a 2 cent fee, and that's all measured in Bitcoin, of course, mm-hmm. then it's going to go through in a minute or 5 minutes or 10 minutes. It's going to be very, very fast.
Yeah. So. Now, these have been around for some time, Bitcoins.
They have been.
How long have they been? Is it like 10 years, 5 years?
A couple years. 2011, okay. I think.
Is that when they really started?
I'm pulling that number out of my brain, and I'm not sure if it's right. But it's maybe 2010 or 2009 or something. It's only been a couple years.
And at the time, it took multiple Bitcoins to get to a dollar. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. It was introduced in 2008 in a paper. by a... And the other interesting thing about this is that the Bitcoin code is all open source. You can all can see all of the code. So you're dealing with a financial system where you can trust because you can actually look at it. You can actually see the code that's running and validate that it works the way it does and that there aren't vulnerabilities.
Okay.
It was actually made by a pseudonymous. I've only read that word before. pseudonymous developer known as Satoshi Nakamoto.
Okay.
And yeah, it's a cryptocurrency. The cool thing about it for me is that the reason it works is because math. It's because math. So now, if you like math, you are going to love reading about Bitcoin. It's really very interesting.
Okay. Exciting for mathematicians.
Yeah. So basically we're creating a currency. Mm-hmm. And people are starting to have some amount of faith in this currency. Now, Bitcoins at one point were worth 1 cent.
Right.
Now they're worth somewhere around $800.
Something above $800. So, and that there's been a recent just spike in their value. And there's a handy chart that you were showing me before the show, Ben, that we're going to link to at geekspeak.org.
Yeah, it's bitcoinwisdom.com.
Okay.
And the reason people are suspecting for the spike is because, first of all, China is very interested in Bitcoins.
Mm.
And also, as of recent news, they're not particularly interested in U.S. dollars anymore.
Uh-oh.
They're going to stop stockpiling U.S. dollars. So that's big news that actually wasn't big news in the States for some reason. I don't know why.
That seems kind of major.
It's pretty
Don't they
major.
Have an awful lot of our debt?
They're still buying a lot of our debt. So if they stop buying our debt, you know, who knows? Anyway, I'm not saying go out and buy a bunch of Bitcoin right now. But I am saying it's a very interesting topic. It's a very interesting thing. And you know, you can
just to track and watch happen.
The other thing that recently happened is there were some Senate hearings where they were talking about the viability of Bitcoin as a currency.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there was no bad news from that. And so the price of Bitcoin went up and up and up and up and up and up and up.
And people had already started to speculate when they heard that the hearings were on, and sort of banking on the idea, as you were, that if things would turn out okay. And in fact, because they didn't sanction them or say Bitcoins shall not be or anything like that. It was pretty much just like a thumbs up from the Senate hearings.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly no.
People are buying them like crazy.
No direct thumbs down from China in recent news.
Now the other
is saying good things, I
guess. Leery. The other thing is that it seems to be infinitely coinable. So a Bitcoin is parsable into lots of teeny tiny units.
Yeah, that's true. So if you take a dollar, if I want to give you less than a dollar, I have a choice of giving you maybe a dime. That's 1/10 of a dollar, or a penny. That's 1/100 of a dollar. After that, we just kind of stop paying attention, and that's because one penny, 1/100 of a dollar, is worth less than it takes the U.S. Mint to create the penny in the first place.
Yeah, the only time we talk in fractions of a penny is at the gas pump.
Because
they always tack it on like 0.99.
That's incredible. Yeah. I didn't think about that. But yeah, absolutely. So it's just the gas pump. Yeah. So Bitcoins, it turns out, you can divide Bitcoins into 100 million units. Mm. So the smallest unit is actually called a Satoshi after the guy.
After the pseudonymous creator.
Yeah. And so one Bitcoin is 100 million Satoshis.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can also talk about millibitcoins because now Bitcoin is almost worth $1,000. So one millibitcoin is about equal to one U.S. dollar. Just to think.
That's kind of boggling.
2 years ago, if you just put $100 in Bitcoin 2 years ago, you would have so much money right now. You would have almost $100,000.
So if you're listening and you've already invested in Bitcoins, you have an official congratulations from those of us here at GeekSpeak. And if you're thinking about getting into the market now, well, good luck. It's like $830 to get one Bitcoin.
See, we're giving people even more incentive to invent time machines, right?
Yes,
so they
yes.
can go back, invest.
You know, I think if we just stay on that campaign, Ben, one day there will be time machines because of our efforts. We're that powerful here at GeekSpeak. Perry of Monterey is right. We should be careful about what we talk about here on the show. Hey, it's time for a break here. You're listening to GeekSpeak on KUSP 88.9. I'm Bonnie Jean Rimsch, and I'm here with Ben Jaffe, and we will be right back.
KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide engineering support for IP telephony, networking, and unified communication. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
The next time on the 7th Avenue Project, another fine program here on KUSP, it's The Making of a Feminist. Host Robert Polly talks to noted literary critic Helene Moghlin about her life as a scholar and activist. Moghlin began her career at a time when women and gender relations were largely ignored in literary criticism, but she says those themes were there all along, fundamentally shaping the stories we tell about ourselves and the world. That's the next 7th Avenue Project tomorrow at noon on 88.9 KUSP. Or KUSP.org. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe. Waiting by the phone to take your call, by the way, is Rick Philman. You can call us and ask anything you'd like at 800-655-5877. And thanks, by the way, to Rick for being on the phones there. But first, you had a couple more things to say about Bitcoins.
Oh,
Ben.
Yeah. Guess who's taking them? Well, Reddit. Have you heard of Reddit?
Reddit's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's basically a link aggregator and forum that's a completely... Yeah.
It's sort of where the internet goes to talk things out, kind of. Really have the big discussions.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. they also are often a company who adopts things early on, you know,
that's kind of early adopters.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of talk, like, for example, there's a subreddit for Bitcoin, so you can read all about Bitcoin there if you want to.
Yeah.
They accept Bitcoins for payment if you want to buy yourself Reddit gold, for example.
Now, what is Reddit gold? What do you buy when you buy things from Reddit?
It's basically just a, it's a better user experience with Reddit. I'm not going to go into necessarily what Reddit Gold is, but it's basically like Reddit Premium or something.
Yeah.
OkCupid. OkCupid is a dating site, and they also apparently will accept Bitcoin. Now, those make sense to me. Yeah. You know, they're companies.
They're internet-based companies.
Exactly. They pretty much live on the internet, so it makes sense that they would be on the forefront. Mm-hmm. Cypress University accepts Bitcoins for tuition fee payments.
Now, is that one of those online universities where you can get your degree online in the comfort of your own home?
No, I think it's actually...
It's a legit bricks and mortar university?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gee.
So that's kind of crazy. That was just a couple days ago that announcement was made. And Virgin Galactic.
Of course.
Of course.
You can count on Branson to...
But isn't that crazy? You can... If you... Let's say threw $100 into Bitcoin.
You can buy your flight in space with Bitcoins.
Yeah, if you, that's ridiculous. Yeah. So anyway, here, have some Bitcoins. I bought them for $80, and now they're worth a flight to space. What?
What?
Almost right.
Wow.
I wish I had invested in Bitcoin that early. But then again, you know, hindsight is 20/20 with investment.
Always. Yeah.
So that's for suborbital flights. Now, if you want to pay in cash, that's $250,000 you're looking at.
Okay.
If you want to pay in Bitcoins, 320 Bitcoins. That's all.
Oh.
That is as of Friday.
As of Friday.
Because Bitcoins are moving around.
Now, they did peak at 900, so who knows if the crash is upon us.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, there was a small crash, and now it's growing. We'll see.
Yeah.
But Lyle has written into us from Paris. He just sent me a message.
How's it going, Lyle?
Yeah, and he said, actually, you can buy with a coin-based account like Bitcoin, and then you can convert to U.S. dollars immediately. So if, basically, if you're a taqueria, you can have someone buy, actually, no, there's even better. There's an actual sushi restaurant.
Uh-huh.
Just down the street from my house, they accept Bitcoins.
Really?
So you can go to the sushi restaurant, you can order your sushi, and hopefully the price doesn't change too much while you're eating. And then you can buy your sushi with Bitcoin. And probably what they're doing, because I mean, maybe it's some entrepreneur running this sushi restaurant and he wants to hoard Bitcoins.
Yeah.
But probably what businesses usually would do is they convert directly to US dollars afterwards, because US dollars are very stable right now.
It's a sushi investment scheme.
Absolutely.
Well, and you've got quite a hopping neighborhood there, Ben. Not only do you have Bitcoin down the street at the sushi restaurant, but also there's a fairly significant building going up near you.
Yeah, that's true. I also, just on that note, I have to say my pocket has been making sounds too, because Lyle's been messaging me. He says, say hi to us on air with my Paris friends. So, hi, Lyle. Hi, Paris friends.
Bonjour.
Hope you guys are doing well.
Or is it bonsoir there right now?
Bonsoir, is it?
I don't know
French.
What time it is in Paris. Je ne parle pas français, it doesn't matter.
I know German, but they're not in Germany, so.
Well, guten Tag.
So yeah, there is another spaceship landing, and that is the new Apple headquarters campus.
Yeah, what? It's looking building. I haven't seen are you going to show it on geekspeak.org? Can we look it up later?
Yes, and I'm going to show it to you right now.
I'm getting a screenshot here.
What does that look like to you?
Okay, that looks like a thing that's going to just spin really fast and then rise up into the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of looks like a... Like
an ultimate frisbee.
If Apple designed a thick frisbee.
Yeah.
That's what it would look like.
And what's going on in the middle there? Is that open land, or is that some sort of green roof?
Yeah, it's open land, I think.
Wow.
The way the current Apple headquarters at One Infinite Loop in Cupertino, of course, they have to have that street
fancy
name.
Address,
that's
yeah.
their current headquarters. And they've got a whole bunch of buildings, and they're all kind of connected, and there's an open courtyard, and then they have Cafe Max in the middle where you can go for a hamburger or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they're going to have a Cafe Max in the middle of this. My guess is probably. But they have this huge open courtyard in the middle, and it's really beautiful. At the same time, if I worked at Apple, I would feel a little bit strange about, you know, like, oh, I can go outside, but I'm still surrounded by the Apple buildings. Like,
yeah, I have not escaped.
Kind of at work. But it's great architecture. This building, despite all the everyone making fun of it for looking like a spaceship, it really is a beautiful building. So at the same time, I don't quite know exactly how I feel about it. I have very complex feelings about it because it is going up within like a couple miles of my house.
Right.
I'm going to drive by it all the time. So maybe it'll look beautiful at the end. I wonder how it'll look when it's going up. It might be very interesting.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, all right. Maybe you'll check back with us and report on progress.
Yeah, I'll be like, oh man, the Apple building looks ugly right now.
All right. But you'll definitely be able to identify it as an Apple building. Right?
It's
Apple
huge and saucer-shaped.
Yeah.
How can one not?
Let's talk about other ways of identifying things. You had mentioned to me before the show that people are paying very close attention to how people type and using that as a way to identify them.
Yeah. So if I write some software and I want to identify you, what I'll say is create a username, create a password. If I'm really, really on top of it, I'll say, you know, give me your phone number and I'll send you a verification code. And then, you know, I'll be basically whenever you log in, I'll be requesting something, you know, a password and something you have access to your phone.
Okay.
And that'll verify me. That'll verify you as Bonnie Jean Primsch.
Okay. That's how it usually works.
That's how Gmail does it and everything. Well, there is kind of a proof of concept that researchers are working on now. Just to be clear, it's not out there
It's not
yet.
A real thing. It's something people are tinkering with.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the idea is when you interact with your computer, you interact with a keyboard in a very specific way. So maybe every time you type the letters A and G next to each other, you always type them really fast or something. Uh-huh. And that's just something about the way your brain sends signals to your fingers to type, right?
Yeah.
It turns out you can actually identify them with a very small margin of error.
Really?
Identify people based on their typing patterns. So
now, wouldn't there be like types of people? How do you take it down? That's interesting to me that it gets down to the individual person level, because I can imagine left-handers would do it a certain way or something like that.
Well, let me give you a statistic.
Okay.
They can identify users of the 2,000 people in the study. They could identify users with a 0.5% margin of error.
Jeez.
Just based on the way that they hit the keyboard keys.
Yeah.
Now, to get this to work, they basically had to calibrate the user's typing. So they did 90-minute typing tests.
Mm.
They did a 90-minute typing test for each of the users, and they basically just sat there and typed a whole bunch of stuff, and the computer recorded, oh, yeah, these letters, they tend to type in this pattern, and it basically pulled a bunch of patterns out of that data.
Yeah.
And then from those patterns, they can use the typing patterns to authenticate users.
Now, when you told this to me, Ben, I thought instantly about spying, but yes, that's not necessarily what it's going to be
used
for.
Well, that was my first thought, too.
Yeah.
Then again, if you have access to someone's computer, they have other problems that are bigger than whether or not you can tell whether they're sitting in front of their computer or not.
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah,
you have access to their machine. So, yeah, my first thought was like, you can identify people by their
yeah, it's a little keyboard
usage. It's just weird.
Yeah.
But at the same time, think about this. You sit down. Let's pretend for a moment that Gmail implements this. Okay.
All right.
You go, you log into your Gmail account and you're typing some emails, and then you go to the bathroom and let's say your college roommate comes over, starts typing things, you know, and sending off emails to people.
Now, this happens all the time on Facebook, right? Like people will, oh, your Facebook's open, and then they'll say embarrassing things about you or, you know, like I'm doing, you know, really rude things in the nude, right? And it looks like you're saying that, but some prankster has made it look like you're saying that.
So what if Facebook and Google implemented some kind of a technology like this? They would say, hey, wait a second. We don't think you're you anymore because your typing pattern completely changed.
Yeah.
So go ahead and type your password again before this email gets sent, before this post gets posted.
Okay.
So I think that's really compelling.
It's like a fail-safe.
That's excellent.
So
I love it.
So it becomes like a security failsafe for the user not to spy on the user.
Exactly. Yeah.
Potentially. If it's used for good, that's how it would be used for good.
Everything can be used for good and
and
evil.
Everything can be used for evil.
So anyway, that's Iowa State University. Good job, guys. That's awesome.
Okay. Well, we'll see how that one develops. Hey, we got a phone call from a neighbor of yours, presumably, Jerry of Cupertino, who also wants to talk about the Apple building. Shall we see what Jerry has to say?
Sure.
Okay. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Good morning. Just a couple of notes, one of which is that since we've been talking a little bit about Snowden and leaks, what you should do is take a look at the Apple architecture, which is this big glass donut, and then go to Google and look for the GCHQ, which is the British version of the NSA, and take a look at their building. And I think you'll be amazed.
Are you making an uncomfortable parallel?
Not necessarily, but architecturally.
They do look strikingly similar.
Yeah.
Ben's checking it out right now.
Yeah. Although the GCHQ building looks like it was built in the 90s by Apple. And the Apple building looks like it was built in 2013.
Right.
Of course, we could link both back to the famous movie, The Hudsucker Proxy.
Okay. So the other thing is that although, you know, you might want to currently what's happening with Apple, if you drive by the old Hewlett-Packard establishment, they're putting up these must be 10 or 12 foot bunker walls, so you can't see inside the area that they're going to be. It may just be for the demolition. But I would expect that they're going to stay up until Apple finishes. So you're not
going to be facing blight.
It's going to be a gated community, if you will. You're not going to be able to go by it and get inside.
Okay. No urban exploring before the fact.
Or perhaps even after the fact.
Or after the fact.
So they may not allow people on the campus afterwards either. I would expect not.
I would be surprised if they kept the walls up after they were done, because with a building like that, you're going to want everyone to see. It's basically a gigantic advertisement.
Well, right, but if you look at the architecture, it's supposed to be completely surrounded by trees and vegetation
and
I don't know that.
Do some natural.
You might be able to see it. They may put up chain link fences, but I don't know that they're going to allow people on.
Mess with the clean lines. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Thanks for the input, Jerry.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
All right.
Oh, another interesting thing is that the news story with the Apple spaceship campus being built is basically that Cupertino gave the green light officially. Not the, this is great, except that, maybe this, here are concerns.
Let's get an environmental impact report.
Yeah, so this is the green light. And one of the most recent changes is that Apple, the city of Cupertino has been giving Apple money to incentivize Apple to stay in Cupertino.
All these years. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. Now,
aren't they already making more than they know what to do with?
The change now is that Cupertino now will not be giving a 50% sales tax rebate, they'll be giving back a 35% sales tax rebate.
That's fair.
But you know, there was a comment where someone basically said, "Now wait a second, Apple has a massive amount of money."
Yeah.
Like, I think the estimate is...
What is a 25% deal on it?
$100 billion cash stockpile.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like...
What's a tax break matter to them?
The difference of 15%, now Apple will be not getting back about $10 million from the city of Cupertino.
Okay.
The city of Cupertino does not have a huge budget.
Right.
I think Apple should be giving money to Cupertino.
At this point...
Or at least not getting it back.
I don't see why they need a break at this point.
Yeah.
But all right, at least it's less than it used to be.
They're not hurting.
All right. Change happens slowly, I guess. What's going on with language learning? I heard there's a new tool out there.
Do you want to learn Spanish?
Well, I already know Espanol, but there's lots of languages I don't know.
Yeah?
My honey speaks all kinds of Asian languages I don't speak.
Oh, wow. Well, Spanish, let's just pretend you want to learn Spanish for a moment. Okay. So, Bonnie, do you want to learn Spanish?
Yes.
Well, I've got just the app for you if you have a dollar. That's a dollar, not a Bitcoin.
Not a Bitcoin, okay. A dollar so, I can afford.
It costs about 99 cents. It's somewhere around 99 cents.
Uh-huh.
But it's by this company called it's by this company that makes a product called Memorize, which I've used extensively to learn things. And Memorize is free. Mm-hmm. So you can go and download that right now.
And it's Memorize, M-E-M-R-I-S-E. They leave the O out for some reason.
Not Memorize, but Memorize.
But you can see they're nodding to that word.
The thing I love about this app for learning language or learning anything for that matter, as opposed to other apps, is that they seem to be paying attention to psychology research, right? So if you are exposed to a term, the way in which you're exposed to the term actually significantly changes the amount of retention you have, right?
Like if it's slapped into your head or if you receive it while getting, you know, some sort of other sensory goodie.
Well, mainly I was just thinking about simply if you are cramming for a test.
Yeah.
You're going to be stuffing it into your head and then you'll regurgitate it out onto the exam scantron.
And that'll be that.
Bleh.
Yeah.
And then it'll go away. You know, it's like all of that knowledge just totally vacates and you're left with very little.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to really learn something like a language and you want it to stick, then you're going to be like... you're going to be exposed to a term and then you're going to be exposed to a term right after and then exposed to a term right after and then there'll be a delay and then you'll be exposed to it again and then there'll be a much longer delay.
So you're talking about the importance of delays and repetition.
Delays and repetition. So that's what Memorize does.
Okay.
Well, it turns out that there's actually another thing that they found, which is that if you include cat photos to as mnemonics, right?
Okay.
Like, if you want to learn how to say, quiero comer una hamburguesa.
Uh-huh. It's hamburguesa.
Hamburguesa. I want to eat a burger.
Yeah.
If you have a picture of a cat on its hind legs looking at a hamburger, people are going to actually retain that Spanish sentence more.
So you get a visual, and why cat specifically? Because wouldn't any visual stimuli, any sort of visual mnemonic help cement something?
I don't know.
How
but cats work
cats?
Better than almost anything else. See, that's the news for me.
That's the power of cats on the internet, right?
Yeah.
There's some other utility there.
Yeah, so the app is
They're
named
not
Cat
just,
Spanish.
Just to cute.
Yeah.
Cat Spanish.
But I mean, like, if you look around the internet, you'll find a couple trends, and one of them is cats everywhere.
Yeah.
Law cats, pictures of funny cats.
Uh-huh.
My sister sends me pictures of her cats all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that
just
motivational
like,
poster.
Oh, by the way, here's a picture of my cats. She's had cats for a long time. She's not tired of it.
No.
So what is it about cats? That's really what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Is like if they decided to turn their powers from good to evil,
what would happen? All be sunk.
Oh, yeah. We could just be gone.
Some would argue that cats are already using their powers for evil.
You know that... Sure.
The Germans thought so long time ago they'd pop them in knapsacks and throw them into the ocean. And then, of course, there was the plague.
Oh, yeah.
They thought they were... Well, because of those eyes. They're weird. Cats are weird. Their eyes are weird.
But they're so cute.
They are mighty cute. I'm a cat person myself. I feel like I should point that out.
I'm a cat person who's allergic to cats. Now, I can't think of anything worse.
Well, good for you if that's the worst thing.
Pity me.
Right.
First world problems.
Should we take a call from Chuck and Salinas? He's interested in the topic about identifying individuals by their typing.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's talk to Chuck. What have you got?
Oh, hi, guys. How are you?
Hi.
Great.
You know, it was so fascinating listening to you talking about identifying people by how they type. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember, but back during the days of code, you know, when they would send Morse code?
Yeah.
Particularly during the war.
Did they identify people by how they wielded the code?
Absolutely.
Really?
They call it your hand.
Ah.
And particularly useful when they were concerned about security. Like if they had an agent in Europe who was sending coded information to, say, England about what was going on, they could identify that person, you know, whether it was really the guy that was sending the information or not by something they call, oh, that's his hand.
That's how he types out the letters.
Dee-dee-dee. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Huh. So I just thought that was an interesting thing with regard to what you were talking about.
Thank you, Chuck. I didn't realize it had such long roots.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Chuck. Keep listening.
Keep up the good work.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Well, look at that. So handwriting has extended to the digital age is basically what I'm hearing.
Of course, the difference is that probably with the Morse code, we were, you know, relying on intuition. Oh, gosh, that feels like it's a little different. Maybe we should, you know, revalidate or something. I mean, now we're talking
about... You've got a very exact algorithm for measuring.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're lagging about 3 milliseconds more than they usually do on these particular keys.
Right.
Or on the space bar. Like, huh. That is beyond the realm of human comprehension, which is why it's so fascinating to me.
Right.
We can't even observe it, really, directly.
We're that much closer to the singularity. That's what I'm hearing. all right. Now, speaking of seeing the intricacies of people, you've heard about something that can identify people by what's on their insides.
Yes, that was a very good segue.
Thank you.
Well, maybe.
that was a passable segue.
I just had to take a meta moment there. But anyway, it's these interesting glasses that you can put on. Now, not you. This is medical technology, which of course means that not only are they as expensive as the parts and the labor to put it together, but they're probably much more expensive because they're in the medical field. Mm-hmm. Everything tends to be a bit more expensive.
That's true.
But anyway, it's this system that was recently unveiled by Epson and Evina Medical.
Mm-hmm.
And they're these smart glasses. Now, we're not talking about Google Glass. We're talking about glasses which specifically are looking for veins in your arms. So think about it. I don't know the name of the person in the hospital who has to put the IV in your arm.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're that person.
Yeah. If you're the IV putter inner person.
IV putter inner person. Now, maybe you'd be maybe very skilled at this, but still, you know, occasionally.
Think about everyone who's ever drawn blood from my sad, sad little arm veins.
Yeah.
Poke, 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 poke.
I'm skinny. I mean, you can see my veins.
There's a vein
just
there.
Fine.
Yeah, I'm
skinny. So it's easy to get me, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Typically, if they stick me, it's the first time,
yeah.
Every single time.
Yeah.
But not necessarily for most people. In fact, studies have shown that up to 40% of IV starts require multiple attempts to locate and access the vein,
mm-hmm.
which means...
causes stress.
It causes stress for the patient.
Yeah.
It wastes the nursing people's time.
Yeah.
If there's a better way to do it,
it's
better do that.
Yeah.
So, what the glasses do is they shine some near-infrared light, and that near-infrared light highlights deoxygenated hemoglobin in a patient's veins.
Mm.
And then they've got two cameras, which means they've got stereoscopy, they've got 3D, so they can kind of figure out exactly where these veins are, and then they can overlay them on your eyes.
Wow.
Not on your eyes, sorry, on the glasses.
On the glasses.
So you're looking through this display, and then you can see on the patient's arm in real time where the veins are, and then you can stick them right the first time.
Okay.
So you can move
on. So that's why this thing was devised, is for more efficient IV sticking inning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's got other technology built in. You can transmit the images using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or even 3G on these models.
Gee.
You can store it on board, so you can document procedures with pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You can take video, all this stuff. But the really interesting part about it for me was looking at your veins without doing anything other than shining light on them. That's pretty
yeah.
cool.
Wow.
And this is not part of the story, but it's another interesting thing that I know about the medical field is that if you look at your finger is actually changing color with the beating of your heart as the blood goes through faster slower.
In more concentrated amounts of blood or not means
a
different color.
There are actually apps on the Android and the iOS App Store that you can download. What they do is they turn on the flash. Just they turn that LED on entirely and just leave it on. And then they say, put your finger on the camera. So it's shining light into your finger with the flash and then looking at it with the camera. And it can actually detect those slight color changes and read your pulse on your phone.
What?
Just using this very basic...
So now we're that step. We're that much closer to our smartphones becoming our tricorder.
Right. Everyone always invokes Star Trek, right? But I love the idea of sensing things non-invasively.
Yeah, that's kind of nice. Well, and they're using that for checking insulin levels, right, for diabetics?
Yeah, there's... at least... I don't know if they have technology out, but I know that there's been a lot of research on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about more interesting geeky things after a break. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. I am Bonnie Jean Primsch hosting today, and with me is Ben Jaffe. We also have Rick Philman taking your calls. If you would like to call into the show, we've got another minute or so. We've got a couple people on the line, but there might be room for you. The number is 800-655-5877. And let's talk to the first of the folks waiting in our queue. It is Eric of Santa Cruz, who also wanted to say a little something about identifying a person by typing. Hello, Eric.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I don't understand how that's going to work because there are so many different input devices now that your typing is likely to be very different on the, if you log in on your smartphone or your tablet or even if it could identify how you're logging in. I have a laptop and sometimes it's a touchscreen laptop. Sometimes I might use the touchscreen function. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have a USB keyboard that I'll plug in because I don't like the keyboard that's built into it. And so my typing's, really different depending on all those different factors.
Eric's making a good point, Ben.
That is a good point.
It's problematic for me.
Yeah. That is a very good point. The research is just talking about this technology kind of in a vacuum, right? But the real interesting question when you see it in actual devices or in actual websites or things like that is how is it going to be implemented, right? It's probably not going to just kick you out of your email and require that you type a certain way in order to type emails. It's probably going to just use that as an extra level of like, ooh, my spidey sense is tingling, maybe this person is different, right?
Right.
If there's a sudden change.
Right, but that's, to me, that's still a hassle because if every other time or every third time or even every fourth time you have to enter your password again, mm-hmm. Just because, you're typing on your USB keyboard instead of the built-in keyboard on the laptop or, I don't even have a smartphone, but I'd imagine for someone who did, it'd be even...
My typing is lousy, by the way, on the smartphone.
Yeah,
lousy.
So I would, like you said, it depends how it's implemented, but...
Consider a fantastical world in which this is implemented in, let's say it's implemented in Gmail as the example again, or in Facebook or something. presumably, if they see you typing and you're typing on your laptop keyboard, and then they see you typing on an external keyboard, and they see both of those enough times, they're going to say, "Oh, okay, this is both of these profiles, both mm-hmm. of these." Calibration profiles are the same user, then it's taken care of that. And then when it comes to mobile devices, right, probably they're not going to implement this technology for mobile devices because when you're typing on a mobile device, there are a lot more factors, right? You can make errors and things. Then again, with a lot of data, you can pull patterns out that you wouldn't have imagined, right?
I'm sure there are patterns in the way I make mistakes on my smartphone.
There probably are. I constantly mistype the comma key as a space, right? So that's part of my profile, whereas other people might not.
So are you implying that Google or Facebook would have the capability to figure out whether I'm typing on an external keyboard on my laptop or the built-in keyboard? Because that's super creepy.
Yeah, I just got creeped out too. Thanks, Eric.
Well, theoretically, yes. if they implemented that feature. Yeah. Now, there are other issues, like JavaScript is single-threaded. That's the language that we use on websites. And so because it's single-threaded, the timing is really not so great. So maybe it can tell a difference of this, you know, 1 millisecond, 5 milliseconds, something like that. But it can't reliably do that.
Wait, let's just get back, because I actually have a – I don't work in tech now, but I have a background in
uh-huh. –
I actually used to be a code developer, and so that means they have, like, are you saying they're going to have access to the processor in the laptops?
No. I'm taking a theoretical technology and just extrapolating what things could conceivably be done in the future.
Are you saying that they would be able to tell whether it's an external keyboard or a built-in keyboard? Because that's going to be, the processor is going to have that information.
Oh, I see. You're saying, is Gmail going to be asking the computer, is this an external keyboard or not? No, probably not. But it might be able to infer that from your typing, right? If you type slightly differently on your internal keyboard or on your external keyboard. So anyway, I mean...
Profile number one for Eric, profile number two for Eric, based on just empirical historical use.
Yeah, I mean, but again, this is all theoretical, and it's really the only point in me covering the story is just to say, hey, this is an interesting way we could do authentication in the future in some situations, right? Now, I haven't really thought this through a lot in terms of, like, exactly which ways it could be applied. Maybe Gmail and Facebook are not the right way to go. Maybe it's on a per-device basis. Maybe the device says, oh, yeah, you're logged into the Ben user account because you're Ben. But then, all of a sudden, a lot of things are different, right? Now, the operating system has access to the kind of timing that we would need for that kind of a thing. So I don't know. I mean, I'm just kind of making stuff up based on ideas of ways you might be able to implement it. But I'm not saying that you could do that necessarily right now, today, or that it would be a good idea in this situation or that situation.
Well, and it might be technology that winds up being the Betamax, right? Like it just never really becomes widely used and developed.
Or like the thumbprint scanners on the computers. I mean, you know, they exist on some Windows PCs, and I have some friends who are very happy with it, but they were not adopted by everybody. So
Could I ask an unrelated question?
Sure.
So, 1 minute.
The last couple of weeks you talked about, or not, maybe not you guys, but you were talking about going to a third-party cell provider that's much cheaper.
Yes.
Yeah, we're taking information from people about that.
Yeah, do you have any update on that? Because I actually have AT&T, and I'd love if it works.
Well, last week Lyle said that he had signed up for Net10, which was complicated to do, but that he's very happy with the resulting service. So that's the latest from our end. And we're interested to hear from other listeners what third-party providers they have found. So
yeah, especially if you have one that you like.
Right.
Because we can hear from tons of people saying AT&T sucks.
We know.
But oh man, like if you have a cell provider that you love or that you're happy with, email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. And definitely in one of the coming shows, we're going to compile any information we get, if we get any responses.
That'd be great.
So stay tuned, Eric.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, Ben, what's a CubeSat?
I'm sorry, what's a CubeSat?
What's a CubeSat? What is that?
CubeSats are awesome. So a CubeSat is a 10-centimeter by 10-centimeter by 10-centimeter box.
Okay.
It's very small.
Small.
Right? And it's built to be a satellite. So usually when we think about satellites, we're talking about like GPS satellites or satellites that map the Earth, that take pictures and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can actually do all kinds of interesting experiments in space in a very small footprint. And so there have been a number of projects. In fact, some kids have even done things like this, and some adults have done things like this, and it costs some money, but you can actually send a small satellite into space with someone who's going up docking with the International Space Station.
Send it. Hey, while you're up there, can you just toss this out the window?
Just toss it out the window. Toss it out the airlock. it's really neat. These projects are really neat. Some of these projects. The thing that I was really tickled about is that the International Space Station has this thing called the GEM Small Satellites Orbital Deployer, which I think is not as cool of a name as it could be. Mm-hmm. Some people are calling it the CubeSat Cannon. It's, you know, just spits out CubeSats. No, I mean, it doesn't, like, launch them at high velocities.
Yeah.
All it has to do is just give it just enough of a push that it kind of floats away from the International Space Station. Uh-huh. It doesn't collide with it later on. But, oh, man, it's so cool. So there's some really neat pictures of these of this little cannon-looking thing and then these little CubeSats floating away towards Earth.
Mm. So we'll have a link to that at geekspeak.org after the show. Stay tuned. If a person wanted to find their way around but they were on a bicycle and they didn't want to have to mess with their smartphone.
Yeah, I got all these cool little fun quick stories.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's
developments.
I want to cover this just because I am a cyclist and I have a lot of friends who are cyclists. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you want to get somewhere but you don't exactly know where. So what do? Well, you do not want to pull out your phone while you're riding your bike.
It's
because
unwieldy.
If you have to brake, then your body moves forward and the one hand that's touching the handlebar will tilt you and you'll end up falling.
Yeah.
Scraping yourself really badly, especially if you're on a road that's really bad news. So don't talk on the phone or use your phone while you're on a bicycle. Make sure you stop first. So how do you do it? Well, there is a new product that's coming out that I was very intrigued about. It's called the Hammerhead Navigation. And it is this little thing that you put on your handlebars, and it kind of looks like the front of a hammerhead shark.
Okay.
It's just like a little thing that goes out in front of you and then to either side.
Okay.
Right?
All right. Got it.
And then
I've got a
picture. Has lights on it. And so it can light up these different lights on it to say, turn right, turn left. It's really fun.
Huh. So it's just a simple directional indicator.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
And that means you don't crash looking at your phone.
Right. Huh. Well, we're listening to the theme music now. That must mean it's the end of the show. This has been Geek Speak for November 23rd, 2013. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is 88.9 KUSP Public Radio and KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you like.